You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Here we go. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the latest episode of the City of Man podcast. Episode 90, I think, actually, today, as this goes out. This is Edward Song. I'm an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. And with me is Professor Coyle Neal, an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Good to see you, Coyle.
How's it going, Ed?
I am well. Actually, what I just said was a lie. It's not good to see you. Listeners cannot see you as I can see you in my little Skype window. But listeners will... So what they can't see is the fact that Coyle is sitting, sweating profusely, sitting in a hot 100-degree box in his office in Southwest Baptist University.
Maybe it is nevertheless still so good for you to see me that spills over onto the listeners. It is such a blessing, even in my gross, awful state.
Oh, Coyle,
more gross and awful than normal.
It is so not a blessing in so many different ways. But listeners, if all of a sudden Coyle's audio disappears, it's because he has collapsed on the floor, and I will probably need to call 911 and get Bolivar Emergency Services to revive him. And if that happens, then we'll post the rest of our episode once Coyle gets out of the hospital.
If that happens, I win the conversation. That's the rule.
That's fine.
Coyle, whoever passes out automatically wins.
I'm glad. Coyle has a bottle of water. I hope you have hydrated well.
Oh, yeah.
So our episode today is a discussion of Patrick Deneen's book, Why Liberalism Failed. This is a book that was published last year in 2018 by Yale University Press that got a lot of attention.
Including a Profiles episode.
Yeah, and so I was going to get to that. Nathan Gilmore interviewed Patrick Deneen on Christian Humanist Profiles back in 2018, maybe in the fall of 2018 or something like that. That's a great episode. Go back and listen to it. Nathan does a really great job, and Deneen is a clear and engaging guest. But the book came to the attention of, well, people like Coyle and I.
Barack Obama.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it was on his reading list. So, you, me, Barack Obama, that's the order.
Yeah. So what I was going to get to in some ways that it got a lot of attention for people who are in the business. And when I say the business, I mean the industry. And when I say the industry, I mean political theory. Insofar as it was a big book. It's actually not a big book. It's a relatively modest book. But that's advancing a pretty broad, sweeping indictment of our social and political structures in engaging ways. And so it got the attention of political theorists. But as Coyle mentioned, even sort of outside the realm of people who think about such esoteric matters as political theory, such as Barack Obama and others, it was on a lot of book review lists, not just those that are put out by political scientists or political philosophers. And so I myself taught the book actually in a class last semester. Coyle has read the book. I think you said that you don't know Deneen personally, but you certainly swing in similar circles.
Yeah, he was, he had just started teaching at, or just finished teaching at Georgetown, I forget which, when I was in grad school in D.C. So I certainly knew people who knew him, and I still know people who knew him, who know him. But largely because I don't tend to like to travel or go to conferences, I've not met him personally. But if I did more of that, I would have.
Yeah, I would definitely say that you all would swing in the same kind of conference.
Yeah, we're members of the same small, obscure traditionalist organizations.
Yeah, and Is there a secret handshake that you both probably know?
If there is, I don't know it. I'm again, I don't travel, so I'm not really inner circle in anything. I'm a hangers-on on the edge.
Of course, if there was a secret handshake, you would probably deny it and precisely say
that's true. That's true.
So we cannot deduce anything by Coyle.
Or I might say I know it and I'm not going to tell you. So in your no, I wouldn't.
Anyways, but Dineen himself is the David A. Potenziani Memorial Chair of Constitutional Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, as Coyle mentioned, he taught at Georgetown and Princeton. He is Roman Catholic. He kind of describes himself as being a Catholic communitarian or a kind of traditionalist conservative of the kind that... The kind of conservative that is a little bit of a rare breed in the United States. The kind of conservative that I would describe you, Coyle, as. And the fact that it is not a mainstream kind of conservatism is one of the things that I think make the book interesting. The book, again, is entitled Why Liberalism Failed. And maybe to start us off, it's helpful to sort of talk about what he means by liberalism. And because his usage is maybe a little bit eccentric, at least with regard to popular usage, and gets at a feature of the book that I think is interesting. Mainly that it's a kind of a broadside against all contemporary political options in contemporary American society.
Yeah, and I think that's fair, right? It's all options. By liberalism, normally I would say, you know, this is small L liberalism, just kind of everything. But it's really such a big thing.
Yeah, and I was like, it's capital L liberalism. So depending on how you think about it, it's either small L liberalism or capital L liberalism.
Every letter in the word capitalized, right? That's how big this is. Basically, it's all mainstream thought in the English speaking world since Hobbes and Locke, right? I mean, it's the monolithic culture that shapes everything since the late 1600s. Maybe it's even broader than that. Maybe we can include the continent, right? Maybe we can include French and German writers. I don't really know enough about thought outside of the English-speaking world to be able to say whether it's as monolithic in those places, but it's certainly omnipresent in the world, right? So
his target is the revolutions in social political thought that happened roughly around the Enlightenment that have gone on to shape social and political organization in the modern world. So when he talks about liberalism, he's not just talking about progressive liberalism of the kind that roughly I subscribe to, but he's even talking about the kind of liberalism that informs mainstream conservative politics.
Right. So Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians, communists, right? They're all going to fall under this broad umbrella.
Well, communists, I think, is another kind of a problem. I mean, communists, I would say, aren't liberals, but...
Oh, well, I think Dineen would say they are... they are certainly liberals, right? They're maybe a side note or an offshoot or whatever the right way to put that is. But you certainly you can't imagine communism growing out of a non-liberal context as a theory.
Well, yeah, I mean, insofar as it's responding to capitalism, but in a lot of ways, I mean, Marxism doesn't really figure in the book.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't engage. He basically doesn't engage anything outside of the English-speaking world.
Yeah, I'm just looking at this. Karl Marx is cited in the index in four specific pages, but they're certainly no long set pieces. He talks about statism, I guess, but
he does deal with communism a bit. Yeah, that's again. I think it's largely because of where his focus is.
Yeah. But yeah, in any case, and the focus is on liberalism, capital L liberalism, or little L liberalism, depending upon your perspective. But in other words, that thing that undergirds all progressive and conservative politics, certainly in the United States, but in the modern world.
Well, and specifically the undergirding being the assumptions that we are all equal, and that we should all be free, right? Those sort of binary concepts or polar concepts, if you want, that equality and freedom are the two core doctrines of, again, everything in the modern world, and going all the way back to Hobbes and Locke.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe it'd be helpful. Let me just read from the very first page of the introduction. And so Deneen says this: a political philosophy conceived some 500 years ago and put into effect at the birth of the United States nearly 250 years later was a wager that political society could be grounded on a different footing, that is, different from the ages before. It conceived humans as rights-bearing individuals who could fashion and pursue for themselves their own version of the good life. Opportunities for liberty were best afforded by a limited government devoted to securing rights, along with a free market economic system that gave space for individual initiative and ambition. Political legitimacy was grounded on a shared belief in an originating social contract to which even newcomers could subscribe, ratified continuously by free and fair elections of responsive representatives. Limited but effective government, rule of law, an independent judiciary, responsive public officials, and free and fair elections were some of the hallmarks of this ascendant order and, by all evidence, wildly successful wager. Right, so all of the stuff that he's talking about there are just the hallmarks of liberal American government, every liberal government in the modern world, especially those of Western Europe, but everywhere there is modern liberal government. And then, right, so, and it's this conception of political order that's rooted in this idea of people as being rights-bearing individuals who should be free to fashion and pursue for themselves their own version of the good life. And then that underlying normative vision of the value of persons manifests itself in a particular kind of political order: democratic rule, rule of law, independent judiciary, and then also importantly a free market economic system. And then, so he thinks that all of that is wildly successful, but then just skipping on a little bit, he thinks that even as it's been wildly successful, it's also failed. And then so Deneen writes this: liberalism has failed, not because it fell short, but because it was true to itself. It has failed because it has succeeded. So he thinks that this order that we take for granted is collapsing or has collapsed, and it has collapsed not because it hasn't been true to its own vision of itself. It's collapsed precisely because it had to collapse as it stayed true to its own inner logic and order.
Right. So because liberalism teaches that everyone should be able to have these freedoms and rights and the ability to pursue their own vision of what the good life is, right? This idea of that it should be applied equally. Well, do we want to get into why it failed? We want to jump into.
Yeah, sure. And so, I mean, the interesting thing about the book is that it's a broadside against modern progressive liberalism and modern conservative liberalism. Like, it's a critique of the way that we do politics, especially in the United States and in the Western world. So it's not, when he says why liberalism failed, it's not just a broadside against progressives like me. It's a broadside against progressives like me and mainstream American conservatives. And so he thinks, you know, both of these, you know, liberalism manifests itself in these two different ways, but both ways are equally problematic.
Right. And because both ways are sharing the same assumptions, just applying
exactly.
them in different places. Right?
Exactly.
So again, the idea is we should all have as individuals the freedom to pursue this life using our rights and our liberties that we define for ourselves. The problem is when Deneen really isn't doing anything unique to himself here, right? This is all just Tocqueville, brought kind of into the 21st century, and which he points out, you know, he's just writing Tocqueville. What happens is we ourselves are not allowed to pursue those things that we want to pursue, or we see someone else who is not able to pursue the lifestyle that they want to pursue, whatever that lifestyle may be. especially when freedom is the dominant rule, because one of the things that happens when everyone's free is some people use that freedom intentionally or unintentionally to stand on top of others or to surpass others or to take advantage of others, or even just because of sort of natural differences, some people pull out ahead and then others are not able to follow as quickly or not able to go the directions that they want to go. So we need the government to step in and change the rules so that those people who are oppressed or marginalized or not able to keep up because of natural inabilities are brought up to speed with everyone else, are facilitated in their pursuit of the good life. The problem is, in order to have a government that is powerful enough and large enough to do that, you start chipping away at those very individual liberties that you were trying to preserve in the first place. And a government that is strong enough to make everyone equal, by definition, is a government that is not going to allow freedom. So liberalism gets caught in this trap of freedom versus equality. Right? If we leave people free, then there are people who are going to be left behind or even actively oppressed. If we don't want that to happen, then freedom is going to be the cost. Now, whether that's the market's doing that, if we're right-wing capitalists, or the government doing that, if we're progressive liberals, that's less relevant. The end result is functionally the same.
Yeah. There's an interesting chapter in here called "Uniting Individual and Statism," in which he makes this argument that both progressive liberalism leads to statism. That argument is a relatively familiar argument for people.
And obviously true.
Yeah, and then I was going to say, but obviously false. Statism is such a nasty word, you know what I mean?
It is.
We have to use
oppressive hand of government. We can say that if we want instead.
I would say that liberalism leads to the need for a robust government. The kind of robust government that we need in order to negotiate the unique problems of the modern world. That's how I would say that.
In order to make people free who would not otherwise be free.
But then, so that, you know, that part of the argument is interesting. That part of the argument isn't surprising. The more interesting, surprising argument is that he actually thinks that conservative liberalism also relies in a similar way upon the state. Though I think that argument is actually an argument that, so that's an argument that I should be sympathetic with. I'm not sure that I actually understand that argument, but that anyways is the claim.
Well, right. So, I mean, there's that. Yeah, just the sort of historic argument side of it. His broader criticism is that it gives rise to the state, but it's also that by protecting the free market completely, right? By that, we will keep the government completely out. You still end up with something that takes away that basic freedom that we were out to protect in the first place. It just ends up being, massive corporations and technology, right? We still have the same loss of freedom. It's just to something different. So it's maybe it's not statism in the strict sense, but the end result is the same, right? And in some ways more pernicious, because people believe that government should be limited. Even the most progressive liberal believes that government should be limited to some extent. The idea that Facebook should be limited, that has not yet really entered our culture.
Yeah. So, in some ways, maybe in some ways, we could organize his critique this way. There's a worry that liberalism leads to statism. That's one thing. Which ultimately ends up oppressing our freedoms. Something else that comes out of it is that he thinks that liberalism is a corrosive anti-culture. And liberalism, like this ideology of people being sovereign individuals, rights-bearing individuals who should be free to pursue their own conception of the good life however they want, is a big part of it. And then he worries that that underlying conception of human beings is an anti-culture. It dissolves culture. It erodes culture. And that's a super bad thing because, as he says, a republic cannot survive in the absence of public things. Like, you need a rich and robust culture that is forming people in the habits of self-governance in order for self-government to thrive. And then in that regard, both progressive liberalism and conservative liberalism are kind of equally anti-cultures.
Oh, yeah. And again, it's maybe one side is using the government, the central government, and the other side is using, Walmart or businesses. But the end result is the same. He has this it's from page 85, the sort of the process by which this happens. This immorality tale is the Hobbesian vision in microcosm. First, tradition and culture must be eliminated as arbitrary and unjust, the natural man. Mm-hmm. Then we see that absent such norms, anarchy ensues. Finding this anarchy unbearable, we turn to a central sovereign as our soul protector, the mortal god, who will protect us from ourselves in the social contract. We have been liberated from all custom and tradition, all authority that sought to educate within the context of ongoing communities, and have replaced these things with a distant authority that punishes us when we abuse our freedoms. And now, lacking any informal and local forms of authority, we are virtually assured that those abuses will regularly occur and that the state will find it necessary to intrude ever more minutely into personal affairs. So the it doesn't have to be the state, although it is also the state, right? And that's what do you think about that, Ed? I mean, I'm sold. I assume you're going to be the one who dissents here.
Well, yeah. I mean, so again, there's the familiar conservative critique of a licentious liberal culture that erodes traditional moral norms, right? So the target there is like Hollywood, right? And this liberal cult and this culture of liberalism that celebrates the individual and therefore erodes shared social practices, moral norms that people experience as being oppressive. So there's that familiar critique.
Well, it's not just that though, right? There's
So that's one part of it, and then the other part of it that is in some ways a little bit more surprising coming from a conservative is right liberalism, classical liberalism, modern American conservatism, in its celebration of the unfettered market, similarly leads to is similarly an anti-culture. And, so there's a long and very interesting chapter, for example, on technology and free markets and the corrosive effects. And, like, your point about Facebook is very, very timely in a lot of ways, right? And so we have these new technology companies that social media companies that are like enabling all of these new social problems that we haven't experienced. So I've just been reading all of these interesting articles about, in the wake of the El Paso shooting, there was attention paid to this website, 8chan, which is one of these, I think it's actually run out of somewhere in Southeast Asia by some weird expat American. But that's one of these kind of underground message boards where a lot of like super hardcore extremist white nationalists get on and kind of and cheer each other on.
Are both of them on it?
Sorry, what do you mean by both?
I mean, there aren't many of them.
Oh. You and Tucker Carlson.
And the author of that Slate article.
Oh, I didn't read that. Who was the author of this?
The Slate Star Codex article that we've talked about.
Oh, yeah.
Times.
That's that argument. Yeah, so when Tucker Carlson said his thing, right? So Tucker Carlson famously, right before he went on hiatus, was like, this is a made-up problem. This is fake news.
I don't think it's a made-up problem. I think the numbers are exacerbated.
You know, that...
numbers are exaggerated. There we go.
So, and that, and his point was, there aren't enough white nationalists to fill a football stadium, was, I think, his line.
Yeah. I would... I mean, depending on which football stadium, but yeah.
And then... I mean, I have two thoughts on that. So, first of all, yeah, depending on which football stadium. So, like, you know, the football stadium at the University of Michigan can hold, like, over 100,000 people. Are there 100,000 white nationalists in the United States? So, I'm going to say they're more than that. You're going to say that they're less than that. And then I'll say, you know, maybe you're right. There, and there's a question about what counts. I mean, I think what counts isn't people who are walking around, who are literally card-carrying members of Identity Europa, right? The number of those people are, yeah, or maybe less than 100,000. That's fine. But, like, what matters isn't the number of people who are formally members of these organizations. What matters are the people who are sympathetic with these organizations. And that, I think, is a much bigger number. I mean, as far as we can tell, the El Paso shooter, for example, it wasn't like he was a card-carrying member. But he was on these message boards and clearly radicalized and encouraged by them. And then I'll say, let's say it is less than 100,000. I mean, let's say even of that group of people who are sympathetic is less than 100,000. I think the danger and the threat they are to our country isn't directly linked to their number. I mean, how many Al-Qaeda members are there? Even, you know, at the height of Al-Qaeda's powers, at the height of ISIS's powers, was it more than 100,000? I mean, maybe it was, but, I mean, I don't know, that's like a ballpark. There weren't a million members of ISIS.
No, but then you have to get into organization and funding, which, it's, so even if I agree, you know, let's say there are 100,000, you know, real dedicated white nationalists, do they have the organization and funding of something like Al-Qaeda? I mean, that's a big claim.
So yeah, that's right. And it's a little bit of a but I think the answer to that question is pretty clearly yes. And so here's the thing. You don't need a lot of funding, actually, because the kind of violence that they're, you know, okay, so white nationalists aren't going to invade Washington, D.C. and take over the Capitol. That's fine. I'm not saying it's that kind of a problem. But they are able to pull off terrorist attacks that generate mass hysteria and fear and kill people. And maybe they're not killing 1,000 people, but they're killing scores of people in ways that they're terrorist acts. The aim is to terrify, and they're doing that. And in order to do that, all you need are assault weapons and encouragement and recruitment. And that's kind of the point about these websites, is that they enable groups to recruit and encourage one another. Yeah. And so I think the answer to your question is, yeah, they have the funding. And then there are even, I mean, you know, there are FBI experts who engage in, you know, who study these groups. And, you know, they recently kicked 4 people out of various parts of the U.S. military for their ties to, and so they were card-carrying members. So those are resources. And, like, those guys, they have access to more dangerous things. I saw one person musing, like, one FBI counterterrorism expert musing, like, do we think it's impossible that there aren't people who are sympathetic with these movements who are airline pilots? You know, I don't know. How many either card-carrying white supremacists or people like the El Paso shooter who are very, very sympathetic, how many do you think there are that are pilots for major airlines?
I mean, again, I don't know enough to speculate on numbers.
Yeah.
But
it's – yeah, right. And my point a little bit is, like, maybe you say there's one. I mean, maybe I say there are 12. I actually don't think that there are 12. But the point is, all you need is one.
So this is, and again, this is going to tie directly back into to Deneen. So your point is, hey, we need protection from this so we can be free. So let's puff up the power of the government sufficient that it can now protect us from this.
Yeah.
Let's increase the reach of the government into the internet so it can go after these 8chan or whatever you said it was called.
Yeah.
Websites around the world.
Yeah.
Let's start kicking people out of the military who have not, I mean, I don't know, had they done something or were they just members of this thing?
They were, I think they're pretty confirmed members of white supremacy.
So let's start kicking people out of the military based on their associations. Let's start.
Do you think it's okay to have white supremacists as part of the government?
As
part of the military?
I think that I'm going to be very hesitant to violate the First Amendment on someone who has not done anything. And maybe these guys did. Maybe they were on these message boards saying, yeah, go do all of this awful stuff. I don't know. But I think, and of course the military, when you're in the military, you do give up a lot of your sort of civil liberties. So I think that's also fair to say, but again, I'm going to be hesitant to endorse doing that in general, however much I might disagree with what the person believes. And again, largely for sort of Deneen style reasons. It's, you know, when they're going after the white supremacists and the people that all of us dislike and disagree with, that's fine. Eventually they're going to be going after someone I agree with, or someone that I like, or someone who's not
so
actually
doing
anything.
That's a slippery slope argument.
It's not just a slippery slope argument. Now the government has that power and we've already given up those particular liberties. So it's not like it's a slippery slope argument. We're there now. If they have in fact kicked people out of the military who haven't done anything, which again, I'm going literally off of the sentence you told. So it may be that these guys are totally guilty. If that is now the criteria, is your membership in an organization that
wants to kick all non-white people out of the United States violently.
Should we kick all members of the Nation of Islam out of the military?
No.
Why not? It's a radical organization that practices or has practiced violence in the past. And it's deeply unpopular.
So they haven't engaged in terrorist acts, indiscriminate terrorist acts against people on the basis of race, color, or ethnicity. I mean, Identity Europa is a terrorist organization. Do you disagree with that sentence?
I don't know that I've heard of Identity Europa other than you telling me about it, so...
That's fine. No, the comment. KKK, which is, like, in decline, and, like, that's old-school racism. Like, that is not cool and hip racism. That's fine. The KKK is a terrorist organization. True or false? They're encouraging violence against black people and Jewish people.
Yeah, again, I am going to... My gut says true.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's fine.
So therefore, if you are a member of the KKK, you have no rights and we can do whatever we want to you.
No.
We can
not
strip you of your employment. We can ostracize you from society.
Not at all. So look, no. You can't just arrest. But this is different than that. Can you allow people who are members of terrorist organizations to be a part of the U.S. military? That is to say, to be a part of this special position in virtue of which you possess very particular kinds of rights and duties that are very different from that of everyday normal citizens.
Sure, sure. And again, I don't know enough about Europa, whatever, to comment on that, or the Klan, really, to comment on that. So obviously, we're not going to let someone who's a member of Al-Qaeda join the U.S. military. But again, would we let someone who's a member of, say, a radical fundamentalist cult, you know, Westboro Baptist? They've kind of disappeared from the media, so maybe we can pick on them.
Yeah, so I would say that that's a different kind of a deal. And then, I mean, I'll also say, like, what if you're just, like, a racist? And then I would say there might be worries, given that the United States Army is integrated, that such a person cannot perform the role, which is going to be involved relying upon and trusting members of ethnic groups that you think you shouldn't associate with. So that would be another kind of special reason. But then I'll say, just in general, a person who's a member of, say, the Westboro Baptist Church, insofar as their views are not disruptive and keep them from fulfilling their obligations and duties as members of the military, I'd say that's fine.
Right. So this group that, again, if they even still exist, regularly calls for the destruction of the United States, celebrates violence against homosexuals, and
they don't
necessarily do anything themselves, but they're cheerleaders for all of these sorts of things.
I mean, I guess advocating violence. I mean, I mean, maybe you're right. And so now I'm bumping up into what I know or don't know about the Westboro Baptist Church. I mean, if they're advocating violence against members of certain groups, then I think that's going to kind of make it hard for you to do your job. If, like, defending the United States is a part of your obligation, but you think that the United States should be punished because of the sin of its culture, then that's a little bit of a conflict.
And obviously, you can't do your job is a different argument, right?
Then
you believe with this thing that we don't like, or you associate with people we don't like. Those are very different things.
Yeah.
No one who can't do the job is brought into the military, at least theoretically.
Yes.
It may even be for, you know, physical disability. You're not allowed into the military because you can't do the job.
Sure.
When that becomes more of an ideological question, that's when I think it gets difficult. And again, that's where I think that these arguments Deneen is making become so relevant, especially as in this chapter, liberalism as anti-culture, when increasingly all of the varieties out there are being exterminated intentionally.
Wait, what the varieties of what are being exterminated?
Varieties of institutions and various cultures around the country.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So you know, for example, let's say there's a club in town that doesn't let poor people in. And the government comes along and says, hey, that's not fair. You have to let these people have the freedom to join as well. So we're changing your rules. Well, what has just happened there? In one sense, everyone's excited because now we have this club that poor people are free to join. In another sense, the freedom of that club to define its own rules and the freedom of us in this town to have a club that defines its own rules has just been exterminated. Right? So we have gained a thing that we wanted in the name of liberty, but the cost of it has been liberty and the growth of the government to shut down this club, the expansion of power of the government. That's Deneen's point. And again, I think it's obviously true, but I understand that I'm already on his side, so that may not be fair.
Yeah, so, you know, there are places where poor people aren't allowed to become members. They're called country clubs.
Oh, sure. A public club, right? We'll say something that's run by a semi-public institution rather than something private.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, I mean, so you think that a restaurant that doesn't serve black people is permissible?
I think that's a really complicated question, but I think what I would say as
Let
a good communitarian.
Yeah, I said that in an antagonistic way.
No, it's okay. It's a fair question. I think what I would say is that I would much prefer that regulations requiring serving people of all races be local rather than federal.
Well, yeah, so that's fine, but. And then I was going to try to put the point more charitably.
Sure.
I mean, but you think that if a locale, say, doesn't put such restrictions on, it's perfectly fine for a restaurant or an employer to do all those things.
I would say it is wicked.
And then to be charitable, you'd be like, I think that's abhorrent.
I think it's wicked.
But they should have the right to
do that. People should be allowed to be wrong. I think communities should be allowed to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And again, maybe this is just where we bump into those problems of liberalism. There are things that I'm going to say, yeah, even that, you know, I don't think communities should be allowed to reinstitute slavery, right? I think there are constitutional bounds that are placed on institutions and communities and so on. But yeah, in general, I tend toward kind of maximum flexibility at the bottom, knowing that's going to mean that there are some places that do really awful things. Maybe even including places where I live, and maybe even including things that are, you know, targeted at me. I understand that, and I think that is, yeah, the alternative to that is, again, this mono state that wipes out all local distinctions.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's interesting. I wasn't planning on having this conversation. These are issues in some ways that I have been thinking about a little bit. I and it's interesting to me. So, you know, you describe yourself as being a kind of traditionalist conservative. But then there are times in which you sound radically libertarian.
When we're talking about the federal government, usually.
I'm sorry?
When we're talking about the federal government, usually.
Yeah. And then I would say, and so that's a libertarian argument, right? It's sort of this conception that people have freedom, and any impingement on that freedom is objectionable.
Right. So with your example of, you know, should a business be allowed to refuse service to a minority? What I would say is, no, I would want to go to my local city government, and I would say, hey, I want a rule on the books that says you may not refuse service to someone based on their race.
Mm-hmm.
Like I would vote for that rule at the city or state level.
Great. But if that rule failed,
then that rule would fail and I would try it again next time.
Yeah. And then, I mean, so I'll say, to me, the problem with that kind of an argument, the libertarian problem, I'm actually working on a chapter thinking about this, is that understanding, the libertarian understanding of the liberal political heritage is rooted in this very radical understanding of liberty. So you will often find libertarians say, just sort of talking about like I keep on capitalizing letters, capital L liberty, that there's this thing called freedom or liberty that we ought to have that should never be impinged. And then I would say that's a really bad, theoretically bad understanding of what rights and liberties are. We don't have a right or a liberty to some general thing called capital F freedom that is the generic ability to do whatever the heck you want to, short of harming other people. I would say this. The reason why rights, the moral force that rights get are rooted in particular aspects of human life that arise out of the particular things that human beings need in order to flourish and have their dignity preserved and to live good lives. So there isn't some generic thing called capital F freedom, but there is freedom of speech. Why? Because speech is an important aspect of human dignity and human goodness. And so that becomes this particular kind of an area that gets protected.
You're working way too hard at this, Ed. Libertarians are wrong because there's original sin.
What does that even mean, though?
I mean, you can't just turn people loose to do whatever they want to do. They're going to do awful things.
Well, sure.
But
if that's the case, that gives you an argument against any kind of right protection.
It gives you that also includes the people who are in charge of enforcing us, in charge of keeping us from doing awful things, right? So it also implies that the governors need restraints on them as well. Now, I don't disagree with you about, you know, freedom of speech being important and the dignity of the human person being relevant to that. I think that's all true also. But I am... going to disagree with anything that is going to try to take restraints off of people, right?
Yeah, so that is
That's like the libertarian. That's exactly the libertarian point. I'm against anything that places restraints on people.
Well, the libertarian point, yeah. So the libertarian point is they're against that. I'm going to say that's a bad position to take. Restraints are good. They keep us from giving
okay,
in fully.
Okay, so if that's the case, why are you concerned about regulations, whether they're federal or local, that place restraints on people violating the freedom and equality of other people?
Well, again, I've come out as in favor of those when they're local. I think that they are. I think there's both a practical element of it's better to hash those out locally. It's better to hammer those things out within local communities. And I think there is value in diversity. So I think that when you have all decisions being made at a national level, if in fact the you know, the federal government does come along and say, hey, here are the list of rules that all universities have to follow for admissions, because this is what we say is fair to everyone else. Well, again, what's just happened there is now there's really only one university in the country, right? There might be a Southwest Baptist and a Westmont and a University of California and a Mizzou and all of the other institutions, but practically we don't have that anymore. Now we just have one university that's defined from the center, which means that if it's good, there's going to be some good components to it, but if it's bad, everyone's going to share those bad components.
So, sorry, are you? I'm not unsympathetic to certain parts of what you said, but I mean, we're both in agreement that we do need a federal government to protect people's rights, right?
Certain very broad rights, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, and then I would just say that you're mistaken about, I mean, so you think, for example, that no state could enslave people?
Right, because we have a 13th Amendment.
And then a federal government that steps in and says, hey, you can't enslave people, that
right.
They're not doing anything wrong.
Because
and
we
the
have
reason
a
they're not minute. Doing anything wrong is because they're protecting important rights.
Right.
And then I would just say that we're having a disagreement not in principle but over of application. And I think you're over application. And I think that your concern about the right to discriminate against other people is kind of rooted in an erroneous libertarian kind of a picture of liberty, as opposed to a picture of liberty that protects very specific rights that have value for very specific reasons. We've talked about this before. Can I just make actually one other point?
Sure.
And, you know, the way that you put the point about universities, I'm not unsympathetic, totally unsympathetic with what you said. But again, to me, I mean, there's a question of if they're not just stepping in just because it's fun to. They're stepping in because they're worried that people's rights are getting violated, right?
Right.
And then
so someone then doesn't have enough freedom, right, as Deneen says.
Well, no, I mean, I wouldn't put it that way. It's that they're being discriminated against.
Sure. And let's even, I mean, often legitimately so, right? Often there is an actual real world wrong being done to the person.
Yeah. You know, the broader point that I was trying to get at is that, like, it is true, I think, in the modern world that we need a very different kind of government that we needed in 1776 or 1789. And that has to do with the complexity of the modern world that we live in, and that there are just new kinds of threats to the rights and liberties that the founders were concerned about that just didn't exist back in the day. And these are new kinds of threats that are features that exist in the modern world. So there's a way in which, like, I think the classical liberal arguments, or even the libertarian arguments, like, I think those arguments make sense if we lived in 18th century America, right? If we lived in a world in which there was basically, it was an agrarian society in which the resource that most landed, that fundamentally mattered, was arable land, and there was basically an inexhaustible supply of it absent those dark-skinned Native American people who we can just get rid of.
Right.
But, you know, if you can always move a little bit farther west and in virtue of hard work and ingenuity make a way for yourself, you know, then I would be a classical liberal.
So back when classical liberals were the progressives, you would have been a classical liberal.
Well, back when we lived in a pre-modern world. But we just don't live in that world anymore. And so like, here's an example. Like, in a globalized world, there is the danger that somebody with some incurable illness is going to get on a plane and fly to the United States, and that an outbreak of Ebola is going to break out, right? And so because of that, like, they didn't need to worry about that in 18th century, you know, America.
Right.
Because nobody was going to get on a plane and bring, they would get on boats and bring smallpox
right
to North America, and that's a whole different story. But anyways, but you see my point.
Sure.
And so in the modern world, you know, we need a CDC. We need a Center for Disease Control. Presumably you're not against the Center of Disease Control.
No. I know so little about it. I'm sure there are things that they do that I disagree
with.
Yeah,
that's
fine.
But the point is that you're okay with the government taxing you it's going to be some small, minute percentage of what they're taxing you. But that money is going to, and I'm trying to think of what part of the federal government the CDC is under. I guess it's Health and Human Services.
Yeah, I would
but
guess
anyways,
so, yeah.
You know, but they're being funded several tens of million dollars a year to do what? To do disease research, to try to do some research funding generation of vaccines. They fund special ops teams that can fly into hot zones and to try to deal with these problems when they break out. You know, they do all of those things, and that's costing you money.
Sure.
And you're okay with that.
I'm okay with that. And I would honestly spend a little more on those sorts
of
things.
Yeah, honestly. We need to make America safe again. And then I'll say, actually, I think everything that the government, this is going to be a little bit tautological, but like, everything that the government should do is exactly like that. So, social welfare programs, controlling, breaking up Facebook or putting certain kinds of constraints on Facebook just because it is literally enabling the spread of white supremacist terrorist groups. That's just like not a problem that George Washington had to deal with. But
no,
he didn't live in the modern age.
They did have to deal with speech, though.
Yeah, but very different kinds of speech. I mean, radically differences, speech problems that were not similar in kind. It's the difference isn't quantitative, it's qualitative. It is a wholly different thing. And so, yeah, so my whole thing is that, like, living in a modern society requires a particular kind of a government. Living in a pre-modern society requires a particular kind of a government. They're just, living in a modern society generates issues and problems and difficulties, threats to people's liberty that just didn't exist in the pre-modern world. And so to do what you needed to do to protect those rights in the pre-modern world, you just need different kinds of things. And look, like, you know, I think prohibitions on students going to Christian colleges receiving funding is a violation of people's liberty, right? I think that's a bad thing for liberal reasons. There are definitely progressives who disagree with me on this question, and we can have debates.
I would disagree with you on that, but I don't think anyone has a civil right to federal government money to go to college.
Well, anyways.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it would be a violation of equality under law, right? You can't treat people in one group one way and then treat everybody else another.
Right, so if the money is going to be provided, then it must be given
to... Yes, so it's a violation of equal treatment under law. And that's wrong. For more reasons than constitutional reasons. but most importantly for moral reasons.
Yeah, I don't disagree with a lot of what you've said, although, again, I think it is sort of proving Deneen's point that, hey, look, this is just the reality. We just need Leviathan. That's the modern world. And
well, yeah. I mean, so I would say, again, like statism, Leviathan, those are pejorative words.
But are they inaccurate?
Sorry, what?
Are they inaccurate?
Well, certainly there are states that are statist and Leviathan-ish, and
sure.
I'm down on that, that violate people's rights. And so I would say that we need a kind of robust government that George Washington didn't need. George Washington didn't need a CDC. We need a CDC.
Yeah, I mean, George Washington needed to protect the integrity of the borders of the nation. Right. So
yeah, we need to do that.
Yeah.
We need to do that.
So the tools that we need to use for that have changed. I as much as I dislike it, I think we probably need a standing army these days. That's a significant chunk of the federal budget that there is a part of me that I wouldn't hate seeing that go away, but it's probably necessary given the speed of transport in the modern world. So yeah, in that sense, I agree with you. The question is more with some of the other stuff you listed that's not clearly a responsibility of the federal government, like welfare, education, healthcare, and so on. I'm even willing to go as far as to say, yeah, I agree with you that those are probably necessities of the modern world. That's why we have state governments. I'm fine with a government version of those. That's what we have state governments for.
Yeah, and then I would say that all of those things, welfare, social welfare programs, what those are doing is that they're ensuring equality of opportunity, which is an important right. And then, you know, in some ways, I think it's fine if states did that, but because it's a right, it's something that needs to generally be protected. And in the absence of states doing that, then it's important for the federal government to step in. I mean, if it were the case that all states were actually doing what they should be doing, then we wouldn't have
right.
a problem.
But then we're back to, you know, is that actually a right? I don't think you have a right to healthcare or a college education or welfare or any of that. You certainly don't have a constitutional right to it. Like, you might have a right in that the government created it, therefore if you qualify, you can get it.
Yeah.
But it would
And then so I'm a little bit uncomfortable with talking about, so just speaking of healthcare, have we done a healthcare episode?
We did on healthcare systems. So we did But I don't think we got into whether or not it was a right.
Yeah. And then so I would say I'm a little bit uncomfortable with talking about a right to healthcare. But I would say that, I mean, to me, having some more nationalized, and there are lots of different ways to accomplish what I think we need to accomplish in order to get universal health care. That's more about a practical solution to a problem that every country in the world has solved because they provide health care that is at least as good, if not better than the United States, cheaper. We've definitely talked about that. So that's like a practical solution. So you can either do it the way that provides, that's more expensive and provides worse health care, or you can provide a form of healthcare that's cheaper and is actually better. And then the reason not to do that is that you're violating people's liberty. And then I would say, no, you're not violating people's liberty, actually, because there's not some liberty to
pick your own doctor.
Yeah.
Choose your medical care.
Or to not be taxed that extra little bit. That's not like a liberty. There's no liberty called you have the right not to be taxed.
No, that's certainly true. I agree with that.
There's not a liberty that says, you know, I think it's a good thing that people are able to exercise choice. And I think that a healthcare system is going to
gut that of any meaning whatsoever.
Well, no, is going to preserve that. But there definitely isn't something called the right to choose your own doctor. Any more than there's a right to healthcare.
If there is any right of healthcare, it should be the right of you and a doctor to agree that, I mean, obviously the doctor should not be forced to
do something to you. Neither should you be forced to receive something.
Right. So there is a liberty of contract there, and everyone who knows con law, just their heads exploded a little bit. But there's a if there is any right to health care at all, it certainly should be that, an agreement that this is the doctor I want on my part, and an agreement from the doctor that, yes, I will treat you on their part. Yeah, but of course, that's not what's under consideration. And that's that's the first thing that has to go in any kind of universal healthcare system.
So I think that's not true at all. And there definitely weren't death panels.
No, there weren't death panels. And for what it's worth, I think that Obama believed it when he told the lie that you can keep, if you like your doctor, you can keep him. I genuinely think he thought it was true. We know for a fact the people who wrote that for him didn't know that, or knew it wasn't true.
That is so not true.
They have bragged about it on national television that they knew it wasn't true when they wrote it anyway. I will post a link to the video in the comments to this episode of the people who wrote that speech.
That's so great. Anyways,
we're way afield from Deneen.
Well, you know, we're having a conversation that I wasn't planning on having.
Yeah,
but it is certainly connected to Deneen. But we should get back and maybe focus a little bit on Deneen's three prescriptions that come out at the end of the book. And so we get this long criticism of leftist liberalism and rightist liberalism. We get these worries that any kind of liberalism is an anti-culture. It erodes the common bonds, the shared practices that bind us together. It erodes moral restraint. It leads to a state that ends up being oppressive. It creates technologies that are out of control. It creates a new aristocracy and inequality. And then what are we going to do about it? And then at the end of the book, in conclusion, Deneen offers three specific initial steps. First, he says, the achievements of liberalism must be acknowledged, and the desire to return to a pre-liberal age must be eschewed. Right? So he's like, there's no going back. Any kind of nostalgia for some magical pre-liberal days is fantastic. And we must build upon those achievements without abandoning the fundamental reasons for its failures. There can be no going back, only forward. Two, we must outgrow the age of ideology. Of the three great modern ideologies, only the oldest and most resilient remains. But liberals mistook the fall of its competitors for the end of history rather than the Pyrrhic victory it really was. The gap between liberalism's claims about itself and the lived reality of citizens widens to the point that it can't be accepted anymore. Instead of trying to conceive a replacement ideology, we should focus on developing practices that foster new forms of culture, household economies, and polis life. So there's an emphasis there that we can't fall back into the age of ideology. The answer isn't in belief or theories, but the answer are in practices that foster new forms of culture. And then third, from the cauldron of such experience and practice, a better theory of politics and society might ultimately emerge. Such a theory must eschew liberalism's ideological dimensions, yet be cognizant of its achievement and the rightful demands it makes, particularly for justice and dignity. So the idea is that maybe eventually we'll get a new theory, but it's going to be a theory that arises out of shared practices and lived life. It will be a theory that recognizes the achievements and rightful demands that liberalism makes, particularly for justice and dignity, but does something different about them. And then, so obviously, there is a kind of an emphasis on the importance of people engaging in communities, shared practices, and regenerating cultures. To regular listeners of the show, that should hearken them back to something, a very specific idea. And in fact, in passing at least, Deneen mentions the Benedict option as maybe a kind of an instance of what this might look like. And faithful listeners will remember way back in, I don't know, do you know what episode?
It's been a while,
but we have a Benedict option episode. The Benedict option, people will remember, is that idea that comes from Rod Dreher that was first articulated in a blog post of his and then developed into a full-length book. That the solution to all of our problems is going to be to retreat Well, maybe that word retreat he might find to be pejorative, but
right to
retreat,
reevaluate, right?
Retrench back into small local communities that are focused on local life, on in the development of shared practices, thick cultures, and which basically we can retreat back into these communities and keep our heads down, try to preserve the flame of civilization until this new dark age passes. The phrase Benedict option Dreher gets actually from the moral philosopher Alistair MacIntyre, who mentions Benedict in passing at the end of his book After Virtue, which is a kind of a critique of modernity. But the idea is that we need to be like Benedict again. Benedict, who went around Europe planting these monasteries, these small communities that were defined by their rule, right, the rule of Benedict, their shared life, and that ended up being the storehouses of the Western intellectual tradition through the Dark Age, right?
What do you think of his options, aside from the Benedict option, which, like you said, we have an episode on?
Yeah, we have an
of
episode.
Of these three steps.
So the little part of me that's kind of communitarian in that way, in a pretty, that finds some of that stuff attractive in ways that are a little bit undeveloped and I couldn't articulate systematically, is sort of like, yeah, that's nice and attractive. To me, my big problem with the book, I mean, there's a criticism that I have of his accusation of sadism that we just spent a lot of time talking about. But to me, like, the big problem with the book is that, like, it's this big critique of liberalism. But to me, like, what he's calling liberalism is a little bit of a caricature. I mean, I should take pains to point that it's like, it's a caricature of something real. Like, there is something like what he describes, but, like, what he describes doesn't get at something essential to liberalism. Like, it isn't the way that liberalism has to be.
So how would you define it?
Well, I mean, so he comes out at the end, and he's like, there's that third point. Sorry, I just lost the page.
183.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, here it is. So he's like, from this cauldron of such experience and practice, a better theory of politics and society might ultimately emerge. Such a theory must eschew liberalism's ideological dimensions, yet be cognizant of its achievements and the rightful demands it makes, particularly for justice and dignity. So he's like, that bit about justice and dignity, we got to keep that. And then I would just say, like, that's what liberalism is. And there's a little bit of a kind of a caricature of this thing called liberalism, that he's like, liberalism is all of these awful things. It's unfettered choice. It's the elevation of the individual. It's the Leviathan state. And I would say, look, I mean, certainly you see those things in the modern world, and those things arise out of liberal political theory. But I would say that liberal political theory isn't essentially all those things in the way that he describes. And at the end of the day, that last bit that he gets at there, we got to keep justice and dignity. I would just say, like, that's actually what liberalism is. Liberalism is this view of this moral view about the organization of states that recognize that people have a certain kinds of intrinsic dignity and rights. And that's just what liberalism is. And then you can take that core idea and you can develop it in a variety of different ways. Maybe it really is the case that there's certain kinds of historical elements and even elements within liberalism that encouraged it to develop in this particular kind of a way. But liberalism fundamentally is about human dignity and human rights, and which is precisely the bit that he wants to preserve. And I would say rightly preserve, because I think all of that is true. But I think there's a kind of a caricature of what liberalism is that gets exaggerated and then kind of secretly snuck back in at the end of the book.
Yeah, and I agree with you with sort of dismissing that third point for sure, in part just because I think it's kind of a nothing point. We need something better. Well, yes. But I mean, if you're to say what we need that's better is not actual, or to say that we need something better is not actually helpful. And this is, I don't know that it's Deneen's fault, because he also is living in the liberal world. So, hey, come up with something that's new and different and better than the world you live in. I mean, that's not really a something that can be done easily, just as if you're living, you know, we just put up our last episode on ancient Rome. If you're living at the end of the Roman Empire, you're not going to write a book about the wonderful feudalism that's coming, because you don't know what's coming, because there's no possible way to know what's coming next. That's just not how things work. So I largely agree with his arguments, and I agree that there is something else coming down the road, but that doesn't actually provide any good or guidance.
Yeah, sorry, I was just thinking about that scene in Monty Python and the Holy Grail when Arthur comes across the serfs in the field. Huh. Maybe we should put a YouTube link up to that. But yeah, I mean, I think the most common criticism that's come up in reviews of the book is that the end is foggy and nebulous, that he doesn't give us any prescriptions. And that actually doesn't bother me so much. I mean, it would be nice in some ways if there was something more specific and illuminating. But I think critique is important.
Sure.
And so it doesn't bother me that at the end that what you get is kind of nebulous. Again, what bothers me is that he sort of defines this straw man thing called liberalism. That's all of these nasty things. And at the end of the book ends up saying, well, we got to preserve liberalism, albeit by another name. Which, yeah, I just feel like the book as a whole is kind of dedicated towards attacking something of a straw man. I mean, a kind of a real straw man, again, but not anything that is essentially the liberal political project. A lot of stuff that gets attached to and grows out of the liberal political project that I think is problematic, especially the libertarian and radical free market enthusiasm of a certain kind of liberal.
Yeah, I don't necessarily disagree with that part.
Yeah, you don't, which is why I appreciate you, or one of the reasons why I appreciate you.
Well, thanks, Ed. I appreciate you too.
Well, maybe on that note, unless you have something final you would like to say.
That's far too positive to go out on. We need to find something. We need to insult each other really well right at the end here.
Well, we could keep talking until you get dehydrated enough to the point at which you pass out, but I thought I would try to be charitable to you.
Fair enough.
Okay, so with that said, thank you for listening to another episode of the City of Man podcast. Go check out Deneen's book. It is a very interesting read, despite the criticisms and worries that I have about it. And also go back, if you haven't listened to Nathan Gilmore's interview of Patrick Deneen on the Profiles podcast. But again, we are proud to be members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. You can check out and learn more about the network in general or our show in particular at christianhumanist.org. Please visit our Facebook page where we occasionally post interesting articles or joust virtually on various different matters. We're at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. You can email us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. Check us out. Subscribe to the show on iTunes, or please rate us so that other people can find the show. And on behalf of my sweaty, dehydrated colleague, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks a lot for listening.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.